It's the 365 Days of Astronomy podcast. Coming in 3, 2, 1.
Listening to the NASA Lunar Science Institute podcast, which highlights the latest news and information of the moon, on the moon, and from the moon. It's produced by the NASA Lunar Science Institute at the Ames Research Center in Moffett Field, California.
Hi, this is Nancy Atkinson for the NASA Lunar Science Institute. The lunar gravity field is rather lumpy and bumpy, affecting spacecraft orbits and making landing on the moon a tricky challenge. Scientists have known the cause of the lumpy gravity since about 1968, when they discovered areas of concentrations of mass, or mass cons, within the moon. But they haven't known for sure what created these mass cons until now. Joining me today is Dr. Jay Malosh, a GRAIL co-investigator at Purdue University in Indiana. Hi, Jay, and welcome to the NLSI podcast.
Hi, Nancy. It's nice to be here.
Well, great. These mass cons have caused headaches for spacecraft engineers and scientists ever since the very first missions launched to orbit the moon. What are they exactly, and how were they initially discovered?
Well, they were initially discovered by a precursor to the Apollo missions around 1968. The Lunar Orbiter series of spacecraft was sent out to sort of scout the moon before the Apollo spacecraft actually landed on it. And what they found is that when they were orbiting the moon, the orbits changed rather inexplicably and rapidly and caused tremendous consternation at the time because it, in fact, required a redesign of the Apollo orbits. The cause of the orbital perturbations was traced down to essentially five large concentrations of mass on the near side of the moon, where the gravity is stronger there than elsewhere on the moon. In fact, the gravity anomalies are stronger than anything that we see on Earth. And it was those anomalies that caused the perturbations in the spacecraft orbit. Ever since, all spacecraft missions orbiting the moon have had to take account of these and often had to maneuver quite frequently in order to adjust the orbit from becoming one that crashed on the moon. At the time they were discovered, after an initial flurry of speculation that covered all kinds of weird things, it was settled that these were large impact basins. The mass anomalies we now know are circular, and they coincide with some of the big impact basins on Moon, with Imbrium, Serenitatis, Nubium, Humorum, and so on. And because those basins are flooded with lava that erupted long, long after the basins formed, it was thought that the reason for the mass anomaly was simply the weight of the lava. We know that the lava actually in places depresses the crust from its weight. The moon's crust is stronger and colder than that of the Earth. And so it was thought that these were supported out of equilibrium, out of floating equilibrium, which is typical for loads on the Earth, by the strength of the moon. And that was what was causing the great mass anomalies. That explanation was accepted and worked in our estimation until the 1990s, when the next gravity mission was flown, the Prospector spacecraft, that made a detailed map of the moon's gravity field. The Prospector spacecraft were among the first to be in polar orbits, and so could map the entire gravity field of the moon. And it was found that, surprisingly, that all of the lunar basins, even the ones without lava, had positive gravity anomalies in the center that were out of equilibrium. And so it wasn't just the lava load. There was something else going on in these impact basins. And at the time, it was a tremendous mystery. We argued quite a bit about whether there was some error in the spacecraft measurements, the reduction was wrong, something like that, because we just could not understand how it is that an impact could create a positive mass anomaly. Now, impacts typically remove mass. You know, the impact occurs, they blast out a bunch of stuff from where the projectile strikes, and that removes mass. We ought to be seeing negative anomalies, not positive anomalies. There shouldn't be any excess mass there.
So what were some of the initial explanations for that?
Okay, well, an early explanation was that, you know, the Big Basin exposed the mantle of the moon, the mantle rebounded and somehow froze in place. But these big impacts actually cause a lot of heating and, in fact, a lot of melting. And so they should have destroyed any possible strength. So it was a real mystery that positive anomalies indicated material being held up against its weight could have existed since the time of the impacts. So until Grail, we were scratching our heads about just what could possibly cause this. As Grail showed, though, the Prospector results are definitely right. And I should also mention Kaguya earlier verified the Prospector results and finding these similar sort of mass cons. Grail has pointed it up even more clearly than Kaguya, although Kaguya was an excellent mission. At any rate, there is definitely a problem. We can't make it go away by suggesting it might be something wrong with the data. It's real. And until recently, we had no idea what was going on. Now we think we understand.
Okay. So the Grail mission, which operated for most of 2012, used two precision flying spacecraft to map the moon's gravity field. Could you tell us a little more about how the spacecraft operated and how they were able to make the very precise gravity maps?
Previous spacecraft measured the moon's gravity by using ranging, that we could measure the range from the Earth to the spacecraft with high precision. And if it was accelerated toward the moon, we could see the baseline from the Earth to the spacecraft increasing. And when it passed over a low-density region, it would pop back up. That's how we measured gravity typically around other planets, on Mars, Venus, Mercury, and so on. That won't work on the moon on the far side, because we don't have line of sight from the Earth to the moon. And in order to make very accurate measurements, we adopted a very different strategy in which we measured the gravity field by ranging between two spacecraft. The two spacecraft flew in essentially the same orbit, separated by 60 to 100 kilometers, and they were constantly exchanging radio signals, very high-frequency radio signals, and measuring the range and the change in range between the spacecraft with high precision. And when I say high, I mean really high. We knew the position of the two spacecraft relative to each other to better than half a micron, half of a millionth of a meter. Whenever there, you know, something changed in the spacecraft, if we fired the thruster, that changed the mass aboard the spacecraft, the center of gravity would shift by maybe a millimeter, and that was a huge signal for us. So we had to take account of all of that, solar radiation forces and so on. But essentially what we were doing is measuring the distance between the two spacecraft with very, very high precision as they moved around the moon. And that distance varied, well, according to a number of things, but what we're interested in is the effect of gravity on that. And that's how we deduce the gravity field, is from those horizontal velocities between the two spacecraft.
Okay. Well, tell us about your recent paper that was published in the journal Science. Using the Grail data, you were able to figure out what created or what generated these mass cons, correct?
Yes, we think we now understand what created the mass cons, and it's not a real simple process that I can explain in a sentence, but I'll try to do it in the minimum number. First of all, as we expected before, the impact occurs, and we ended up with a mass deficit, and we evaluated what happened in the impact by using a suite of computer programs called hydrocodes that will calculate the events that occurred during an impact with very great precision. We could see then that these really big impacts melt a great deal of the moon. They They mobilize both the moon's mantle and crust. The crust is folded back on itself to make a thicker collar to the center of the basin. The mantle material, now melted, rises up in the center. And the entire structure, though, subsides into the hole created by the impact. And we end up with a negative anomaly, with a denser, mantle-rich center. The crust, in some cases, flows back over it. But, you know, there is a mantle uplift underneath, surrounded by a thickened collar of crust that has been bent down as it moved into the crater. And because the crust is colder, it still has some strength. It may be broken, but it still has the same frictional strength that a pile of sand does. And so it essentially held that collar of crust down into the moon and made the negative anomaly even greater than it would otherwise be. So that's the end of a couple of hours after the impact event. We have this big negative hole with crust and mantle. What happens later is what makes the positive anomaly, and that's the slow rebound over time of the mantle material, the cooling of the melted mantle, which makes it denser, and as it cools, it tends to contract and would subside even more, except that the lighter crust around tends to support it. As the top cools, it becomes stronger. The crust then freezes to it, supports it, and the whole mass, as it relaxes, ends up with the mantle material, now cooling and getting denser, being essentially buoyed upward by the collar of crust around it, and producing the characteristic feature that we see of a positive center surrounded by a negative annulus or halo kind of negative anomalies, and then with a bit of positive anomaly beyond that, which represents ejecta that has been loaded onto the strong crust. So it's a complicated story, but thanks to our current ability to model both the short-term and long-term events that happen after a big impact, we can now reproduce the observed gravity anomaly as well as topography with very, very high fidelity. And we're pretty sure that this is, in fact, what happened after an impact. In some ways, it's really an inevitable consequence of a big impact that occurs on a planet. We expect to see very similar things on Mars and on Mercury when we get good enough gravity to detect those. As it is on Mars, some of the big basins like Isidis and Helidus seem to show such positive anomalies. On Mercury, we see a positive anomaly associated with the giant Caloris basin. So we think we may be looking at a similar process.
Okay. Was any of this, of the findings that you made, was it any of it really surprising to you, or does it all kind of fit together really well?
Well, I think it all fits together pretty well. What I guess I was surprised at is when we saw the Grail maps, how completely the big basins stand out. They're essentially bullseyes. And when you do the gravity maps, you color positive red, negative blue, you see what almost looks like a target of red centers with a blue ring and then a red ring around it. They look like bullseye targets. They're very, very distinctive features of the moon's crust. Another surprise that we saw, there's been a lot of speculation about possible ancient basins on the moon that we don't see because they've been covered over with younger basins. But it's harder to eliminate the gravity anomaly than it is the surface expression of a basin. We expected to see some older basins from their gravity signature that didn't show up in the topography of the surface of the moon. What we discovered is that there aren't any such basins. That may be telling us that instead of a long series of ancient impacts, the moon's crust formed after it accreted together. There was a period of quiet where there weren't too many impacts, and then there was a fusillade of many impacts during the late heavy bombardment, and then it stopped. So we may be looking at a relatively short era of impact, but there don't seem to be very many missing big basins on the moon.
Okay. We had talked with GRAIL's principal investigator, Maria Zuber, for a previous podcast, and she said that these gravity field maps are the most precise for any planetary body, including Earth. How will these maps and how will knowing more about mass cons help for future lunar missions? And could it help with missions to other planetary bodies as well?
Well, they help tremendously with lunar missions because every orbiter around the moon has to navigate itself. And without knowing the gravity field, you just can't navigate very well. In fact, we have already improved LROs, the Lunar Reconnaissance Orbiter's knowledge of their position with our improved gravity field. Of course, they observe things on the surface of the moon with very high precision, but until they could navigate better, they didn't know exactly where they were. And using the GRAIL gravity field, they've already greatly improved their knowledge of their absolute position on the surface of the moon. For future missions, in particular for landers, it's imperative to know the gravity field of the moon with very high precision because all of these missions use inertial navigation systems. And for inertial navigation, the gravity field is crucial. So we have, with GRAIL, made a huge contribution to our ability simply to navigate around the moon. For other planets, you know, like Mars and Venus, we can't get, or the Earth, we can't get close enough to the surface. GRAIL is very similar in concept, in fact, similar spacecraft to the GRACE mission, which is currently in orbit around the Earth, measuring the Earth's gravity field with very high precision. But because of Earth's atmosphere, GRACE has to fly at 550 kilometers, and it has nowhere near the kind of resolution on the Earth's surface that we're getting on the moon.
Okay. Well, Jay Malosh, congrats to you and your team for solving this mystery of the mass cons, and thank you very much for talking with us today.
Okay. Thank you, Nancy.
To find out more about this topic, visit our website at www.lunarscience.nasa.gov. Any opinions expressed are those of the individual and do not necessarily reflect the opinion of NASA or the NASA Lunar Science Institute. This podcast is produced for educational and information purposes only. On behalf of the NASA Lunar Science Institute, thanks for listening.
You are listening to the IYA 365 Days of Astronomy podcast.
The 365 Days of Astronomy podcast is produced by Astrosphere New Media Association. Audio post-production by Richard Drum. Bandwidth donated by Libsyn.com and Wizard Media. Web design by Clockwork Active Media Systems. You may reproduce and distribute this audio for non-commercial purposes. Please consider supporting the podcast with a few dollars or euros. Visit us on the web at 365daysofastronomy.org or email us at info@365daysofastronomy.org. Until tomorrow, goodbye.